Good morning. The Hawaii Environmental Funders Group debuts its first State of the Environment report today. Amy Hennessy of Ulupono Initiative joins us later in the hour. Meanwhile, another environmental group wants a trash wheel for the Alawai. It crowdfunded for a feasibility study now underway. We'll get a status report from Kahi Pakaro, the Executive Director of Sustainable Coastlines. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. How often when you're reading a book do you wish you could talk with the author? A new series of Books and Spirits evenings offers that opportunity. And how much can we learn from looking at our own brainwaves? Can that help us bring them under control? We'll hear from Maui-based neurofeedback practitioner Stephanie Garcia.
That's the conversation for this Wednesday, August 17th. Now the news. And happy midweek to you, too. It's a Wednesday. This is The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Good morning. And good morning to you, Chris Vandercook.
Good morning, Beth Ann. You're taking out the trash this morning.
Well, yeah, that's kind of one of my jobs that I always get to do. But there may be something that's taken out a lot more trash for all of us in maybe not just warmer than a few years or so. Now, for the past 2 years, Baltimore's Inner Harbor has gotten a lot of help cleaning up after floating garbage. Mr. Trash Wheel, an almost sea snail-looking machine, cruises the harbor, gobbling up an array of plastic cast-offs plus cigarette butts. The trash wheel runs on water and sunlight and for a while has drawn the attention of a Hawaii environmental group that's working to bring a trash wheel to the Alawai Canal. Sustainable Coastlines ran an Indiegogo campaign to raise funds for the feasibility study recently started, which gives hope to Executive Director Kahi Pakaro that a trash wheel could be in operation by 2018. Kahi Pakaro, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Beth, and great to be here.
This little, well, it's not such a little machine, but the one in the Inner Harbor in Baltimore, it's cute. I mean, you can't look at this thing and think, okay, that's not, it has little eyeballs on it. We don't necessarily have to have a version that looks like that. But one of the other things that it does is to help bring attention to a lot of the issues that plague the Inner Harbor there as well as with the Alawai here. The machine itself would be, you know, able to pick up all these pieces of garbage. I think they said they've had 441 tons of garbage picked up in the Inner Harbor in Baltimore since, the 2 years or so that's been in operation. But for us here, what are your hopes for this machine in terms of what it would do on the Alawai?
Well, first off, it was the beach cleanups and seeing all the trash washing up ashore that not just us at Sustainable Coastlines, but Surf Rider Foundation and 808 Cleanups and even Kokua Hawaii Foundation realized there needed to be more done. It really comes to education and moving closer to the source of where the debris is coming from. The trash water wheel represents an opportunity to catch the lion's share of Oahu's marine debris that's headed out into the ocean to become marine debris. So what it's going to be able to do is divert close to 95, if not more, percent of the trash that is flowing out of the Alawai watershed and being able to not just remove it, but show the community what we're finding and hopefully encourage and educate them to use less and have better waste management skills.
You'll also be getting or collecting demonstrable data, not just anecdotal stuff of look at all that garbage out there, but, you know, to be able to collect it and say this is how much we have. You're also going to be doing water quality studies with this, aren't you?
We haven't addressed the water quality issues quite yet, but Surf Rider Foundation is currently doing some great water quality work and have just started it up again. So they'd be better to speak to the water quality issues, but we will be improving water quality in the sense of removing tons of debris, of which ends up being absorbing a lot of the pollutants and pesticides and fertilizers.
But with this machine, it has the ability to be able to sample for you.
True. Yes, it we could definitely sample from it. But currently our main objective is to remove the physical debris that's getting sent out into the ocean.
All the plastic pieces of all kinds of stuff, bottles and bags and
cigarette butts. And not just that, the organic materials as well, of which we're going to try to pull out the recyclables that we can, and the rest of it's going to be going to H-Power, our trash to energy facility.
So right now the feasibility team is here, and they're doing interviews. Yeah?
They're doing interviews. They're also doing analysis of the actual physical site where it's going to go. They're meeting with the different stakeholders around the Olowy watershed, and we're assessing what it's going to take to get the trash water wheel here and installed.
When they're talking to stakeholders, I can imagine, given the fact that we're talking about the Olowy, that you have a lot of them, including a lot of people who use the Olowy for paddling or just are concerned about what this thing might be as they're looking out their windows of their condo.
Yeah, I think one of the main stakeholders we want to speak with are the canoe paddlers and the kayakers. Being a kayaker myself, I spend a lot of time on the Olowy. Going through the bridges is very important. You got to get out to the ocean, etc. And we're not there to block access. We're still going to provide access, but we want to make sure the way that we do it is conducive to their use. But in the end, we got to also realize as a team that, hey, this is going to be improving the Olowy and improving the ocean.
The Indiegogo Indiegogo crowdfunding that you did got you to this point. But to be able to actually get this huge project underway, you're going to have a lot more money, about $900,000?
Yeah. So,
and you've got about a third of that the city has pledged?
So currently the first step was the feasibility study, which we had funded in 6 days with over 200 people donating just small amounts of money. Moving forward, yes, the estimated cost that we are seeing for the trash water wheel to be installed in the Olowy Harbor altogether is supposed to be $750,000, but that's a bid from the mainland. So then we put on the contingency of Hawaii, and we're looking somewhere near $9 to potentially $1 million, of which currently the city and council has allocated $350,000 to it, but that also means that the mayor needs to release it. We have the state opportunity to apply for grants and aid, which we feel we feel very comfortable that we can acquire that. We have the federal government through NOAA and the EPA that has multiple grant monies available for projects just like this. And the fact that we have nonprofits, Surfrider Foundation, Sustainable Coastlines, Kokua, and 808 Cleanups driving it, raising money for this project, we believe is possible. But we don't just want to rely on grant money. We want to also reach out to the businesses around there that are going to benefit by having a clean Olowy Harbor, and then also do like we did with our crowdfunding campaign, get residents all to chip in $5 the way that Obama and Bernie did so well. And just that way we all get a bit more of a stake in it and some ownership in the trash water wheel.
Which seems to be, the real point of it, not to have it just simply, gifted and put out there, but to have the connection made between what people's actions produce and actions that they can use to be able to clean it up or stop it altogether.
Exactly.
So at this point, we're going to wait for this feasibility study, which is expected to be finished and in your hands by when?
We're hoping to have this study within 2 months. And at that point, let's start seeing. Hopefully it comes through and says, hey, this is possible, and all signs show that it is possible. But to release monies, et cetera, we have to have a feasibility study that shows how we're going to do it. And once we get there, we're going to be starting to talk with the city. I was talking with the state and the feds about how we can secure dollars for this project.
And you'll be back to talk to us, and we'll find out more about what the feasibility study said. I don't know what's going on with my mouth this morning.
It's a tongue twister, don't worry.
No, feasibility study. We should all be able to say that. But anyway, thank you so much
being
here, and we'll talk to you in the not-too-distant future.
Sounds good. Aloha.
Kahi Pakaro is the executive director and co-founder of Sustainable Coastlines Hawaii.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:13, and coming up, a new literary salon starts up in Honolulu. But first, your quiz.
For today's backyard quiz, we got to thinking about the history of Greeks in Hawaii after our conversation yesterday about the upcoming Greek festival. Greeks were in the islands as early as Captain Vancouver's expedition here and have taken up residence as had taken up residence as whalers and traders as early as the 1830s. By the 1880s, a number of Greek-owned businesses had become well-established, and they put local Greeks in conflict with the missionary community. One Greek businessman, a man whose name we're looking for today, entered into partnership with Campbell, Marshall & Company, a venture that went sour. Lawsuits and countersuits between the principals put this man and the whole Greek community at odds with conservative missionaries. The businessman became an ardent opponent of the overthrow of the monarchy and later died in a mainland asylum under mysterious circumstances. This morning, we're looking for his name, and if you know it, you should call us very quickly at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, because the first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Good morning, I'm Christopher G. from Misa No Ale. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
With all that we hear about the digital revolution, reading, the kind that involves real books, the kind you hold in your hand, still has its advocates, and we can all be grateful. Readers know that one's experience of a book can only be enhanced by an opportunity to meet with the author. With that thought in mind, writer Stuart Coleman is organizing a new series of literary evenings called Books and Spirits, and he's with us in our studio. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning.
When you read a book that you like, a lot of times you have questions you would like to ask the author, right?
Exactly.
Was that kind of what was in your mind when you put this together?
Yeah, I had a friend who runs a local book club, and she said, oh, we're reading this great author, and God, I wish I could talk to him. And it turns out I knew him. It was David Helvart, who's going to be our next speaker. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, you know, I can put you in touch with him. And she was just so thrilled. And I thought, well, I know a lot of writers, and it would be great to bring them to the islands and, you know, to really encourage reading books again, which is, you know, yeah. A lot of people complain they don't have time.
In, you know, on the East Coast and in New England, the reading in a local bookstore is a fairly common phenomenon.
Exactly. And I hadn't been to a lot in Hawaii.
Yeah.
And missed those.
Well, What's the broader plan for getting this? What other authors are you looking for?
Well, we're looking for authors who kind of have some local touch in Hawaii, whether they've lived here or write about Hawaii, and or, you know, are connected to our love of the environment here. Mm-hmm. and the ocean, because that's kind of my background.
Sure.
And so Jamal Yogas was a perfect first choice for our author coming up tomorrow night, because he had written two books that I just love, kind of combining his love of Zen, Buddhism, and surfing.
Which are pretty compatible, aren't they?
Yeah, they really are.
His book is called The Saltwater Buddha.
Yes, and it's called A Surfer's Quest to Find Zen on the Sea.
So what is that? I mean, how does he describe that? I haven't read the book.
Yeah, it's a fascinating memoir and kind of comedic coming-of-age story about him running away to Hawaii and leaving a note for his parents that said, you know, I'm somewhere in the world, don't try to find me. I'll write you when I get there.
And I would think that reading it would take you through one of the fundamental pleasures of the reader, which is living a vicarious life. Right?
Exactly. And it's quite an adventurous life. And it's a story about, you know, alienation from his parents and running away. And then when he gets to Hawaii, not knowing what to do or where to live, and he finds some peace and contentment through, you know, being on the ocean and surfing, although it's very funny to get to that. Before he gets to that sense of peace, there are a lot of, you know, hysterical adventures that he goes on.
Do you have the sense, Stuart, that there are more and more books that are sort of intersecting with Hawaii and Hawaii's concerns? It seems to me that way.
Yeah, it does. I think we have something special here, and people realize it, and they are, you know, drawn to, you know, this vision of not just the stereotypical version of paradise that tourists, you know, might be seeking, but a real complex culture where so many different ethnic groups live together in a small space, and, you know, where environment's still important.
And within the complexity of that culture, I would say there are a great many subjects yet to be tackled, wouldn't you?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. You know, we have the stereotype of Hawaii, and then we have the reality, and there's so many ways to explore that kind of reality, I think, that haven't been done yet.
Which would mean that there were probably writers out there that haven't done anything yet that could use a little encouragement.
Yeah. Exactly. And add to, you know, some spirits involved. We wanted to, you know, get people to make it a fun event. Mm-hmm. And cocktails right now are just so... you have mixologists, and we have award-winning, internationally recognized mixologists here in Hawaii. And I thought, well, let's see if we can combine the two. You know,
it wouldn't be the first time that literature and mixology, you know, been compatible with one another.
Exactly.
Right? When I think about past literary traditions, so many of them were built around one form or another of the salon, or, you know, the gathering. You know, the expatriates in Paris between the wars, or, mm-hmm. you know, earlier in mid-century Paris with Baudelaire and his buddies. But if you can get that kind of cross-fertilization going, it sort of lifts all boats, don't you think?
Yeah, and you know, someone referred to it, and I don't know if it was a typo or not, and they said a literary saloon, and I thought, that might be just right, actually.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there's a considerable overlap in some of them between the two categories. But when you interact with other writers, you said you talk with other writers on mm-hmm. book tours. What kind of things do you get out of those encounters?
You know, I'm just supremely interested in individuals and what makes people tick, and authors in particular have you know, explored their own lives and in such detail that it really is kind of fascinating to see if they can put together a vision or a story that's, you know, compelling. And having gone through that process to get published and to go out there and to do the book tours, I know what a labor of love it is. You don't do it for the money.
Yeah.
And so I'm really intrigued by, you know, people who've committed so many thousands of hours to, you know, bringing that reality to life. And so, you know, during our conversations at Books and Spirits, we're going to be, you know, just talking about, like, the creative process, and not just, you know, their own particular book, but about, you know, what brought them to Hawaii and what makes Hawaii unique.
Yeah.
And you know, what is the state of books when we live in a culture that is so obsessed with images and you know, can't focus for more than 15 seconds. You know, that's too long a video, you know.
And you know, so if I were a 19-year-old aspiring novelist who wanted to write a 900-page epic, I might be a little bit discouraged by that.
Exactly.
You know, if I wanted to do my War and Peace or something.
Yeah.
How do you deal with the fact that the audience is sort of evaporating?
Yeah, you know, I need to find the recent statistics, but it's said that, you know, that book publishing, we thought everything was going towards online and the traditional book publishing industry was dying, but apparently it has made a comeback, that people like reading online, but they're also hungering for books. And as someone who struggles with a little ADD myself, I found an anxiety at times. Reading has been one of the most therapeutic things for me. I mean, it literally brings me a sense of peace and calm that I can't find, you know, except maybe surfing on the ocean.
Yeah. It's similar, and if you somehow feel as if your heartbeat is sort of slowing to its appropriate rate. You know, your breathing is getting in sync.
Yeah, exactly.
You feel that?
Yeah, definitely. And then, you know, when you get to exciting parts of the book and it starts to speed up, you're aware of it, and it's kind of, it's neat. You know, you have to kind of breathe through it like, this is exciting, you know. And
no, it's the kind of pleasure, and which is what you're doing. It's the kind of pleasure you want to share with everyone.
Yeah, exactly. And it's great to have, you know, we have some of the best restaurants preparing food and drink. You know, Mud Hen Water will be doing the first one. And
sounds like the ingredients of an evening.
Yes, exactly.
Thanks so much.
Stuart. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Stuart Coleman is coordinator of Books and Spirits, a series of literary evenings. The first, tomorrow evening at Revolution Smart Home in Kaka'ako, will feature Jamal Yogis, the author of The Saltwater Buddha and The Fear Project. Details are on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Bronster Fujichaku Robbins, a civil litigation law firm handling major cases on all islands for clients of all sizes, from individuals to Fortune 500 corporations. BFRHawaii.com.
For the fourth year in a row, Hawaii Public Radio has been recognized with 4 stars by the nation's largest charity evaluator. Charity Navigator's top rating gives you confidence that your donation will be used efficiently and responsibly. We thank these members who have recently shown us their trust and support: Barbara Green of Kailua, Teresa Rainey of Lihue, and David and Sharon Best of Honolulu. You can find a link to our Charity Navigator ranking at hawaiipublicradio.org, and we're here to answer your questions about giving to Hawaii Public Radio when you call us at 955-8821 during business hours. Thanks. A parasite that can kill monk seals and other animals has a singular host in which the parasite can mature and reproduce, a cat. And that has marine conservationists concerned over cat colonies where cat poop is making its way to the ocean. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Now, we're talking about toxoplasmosis, and I remember that, you know, when I was pregnant, being warned, stay away from the cat box, stay away from the, I mean, all of that. But there was never the extension of all of that into what toxoplasmosis could do to other mammals, particularly marine mammals, and in this case, monk seals.
Right. It spread through the cat feces or poop, as you, I guess we could say poop on public radio.
You can say poop.
But it is a very serious issue. It spreads through the watershed, food and water. Other animals can ingest the matter as well. And scientists have determined that at least 8 monk seals have died from toxoplasmosis. 2 spinner dolphins, as well as nene and other native birds over the past 13 years. So it's a very serious problem. Nathan Eagle's story today outlines the challenges. What's stunning to me is that there are 300,000 feral cats, homeless cats on Oahu alone, hundreds of thousands more estimated for the neighbor islands. 300,000 feral cats. Wow.
And that's a lot of poop coming from those cats. And for all cat lovers who say, you know, but that's just part of having, you know, a cat. Well, if that's in your home, that's one thing. But if, you know, you've got cats out there who have either been dumped because people don't want the pets anymore, or simply the cat colonies have been reproducing, that's a tough one to be able to counter. What do some of the experts say might be a solution that's not going to involve perhaps culling the cats, or is that in fact what they are saying?
Well, that is one of the proposals, and it's actually pitting one group against the other, basically scientists versus advocates for protecting the cats. So scientists, along with the Hawaiian Humane Society, have moved towards trap, neuter, release, and manage. That way they think they control the problem. Others, however, including the NOAA and the Department of Land and Natural Resources, have said culling, that is, killing cats, may be the only solution. Remember, cats are not part of the native ecosystem here in Hawaii. And yes, if you keep them indoors, that's a good thing, but many cats get out. And then what about people that have a bunch of kittens, can't give them away, and they just drop them off at one of those colonies? Boy, there's colonies. You'll find one in Hawaii Kai, UH Manoa, Waianae. They're all over the place. So this is a real challenge. They can't seem to reach agreement on what the best approach is to dealing with the colonies.
And people very frequently will dump the kittens into a colony where they know people are coming to feed and to take care of them. Now, isn't toxoplasmosis more prevalent in kittens than in adult cats?
That's correct. And that's why most experts say education is absolutely the best thing, to get out the word about where toxoplasmosis is found, where it's most predominant, to make sure that you're not abandoning pets, that you are getting them spayed, that you're keeping them indoors. There's a number of things that we can do as a public to help reduce this very serious problem, because we're talking about endangered animals. The Hawaiian monk seal, for example, nene. These are creatures that we need to protect. They are part of Hawaii.
So at this point, we really don't have a defined solution for this, simply more light shed on the problem. Thanks very much, Chad.
Thanks, Bethann.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat and joins us daily with a reality check.
Good morning, I'm Alton Chung, and you're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, live on the web at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa, and Bert's on the line to tell me about bugs.
Bugs that bite, and bugs that primarily have not the itchy kind of bugs, but the kind that have venom, and that's a particularly potent kind of mixture.
Yeah.
And these would be probably things like scorpions and centipedes and spiders and things that make you feel sore.
Yeah, they're doing a good job too.
Well, we invited Christy Wilcox, and she's a PhD over at UH. Just came out with a book called Venomous. And she actually does quite a comprehensive study of all kinds of, not only bugs, but animals that have things like, poisonous venoms as part of their defense mechanism. So we'll get to talk about, what kinds of animals have this, how did they evolve to do that, how do they, and how do we as humans learn from these particular creatures? And evidently there are a lot of studies and research going on into how those venoms could be leveraged for some medicines.
I was wondering about that, Bert. It would seem that, such powerful chemicals would have some possibilities there.
You know, nature is never ceases to amaze me, because it's like a little, biochemical factory, and
yeah,
it can create all kinds of interesting things. So we'll learn about that with Christy and find out what kinds of uses there are. And should we actually have a newfound respect for these creepy crawlies?
Oh, I do already, Bert.
So, yeah, we'll have a thought. We'll have a good conversation about that, and for people to call in and then ask them, and have them ask about what their favorite creepy, crawly, venomous creature might be.
Sounds like a plan, Bert. Thanks a lot.
Sure thing.
At Bite Marks Cafe tonight at 5 p.m.
Today, the Hawaii Environmental Funders Group releases its first State of the Environment report. The effort, called Helono Moko, is the State of Environmental Hawaii 2016. It is the product of 17 organizations working through the Hawaii Community Foundation. The goal is to track the progress of current resource protection while identifying future impact opportunities. Each year, the report will focus on different priorities. The inaugural report takes on three areas: freshwater security, renewable energy, and community-based marine management. Amy Hennessy of the Ulupono Initiative represents one member of the group producing this study, and she's in our studio this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here.
Glad to be here.
Now, with a lot of reports that we see, they're dense, they're difficult. Forget pretty pictures and all the rest of it, but just trying to get through some of the facts, the figures, and the science can be difficult. It's absolutely the opposite with this report. I mean, it's a whopping 9 pages, and it's very easily digestible in the bits and pieces that you've put out there. Was that a concerted effort?
Absolutely. I think for us, we looked at other models of reports throughout the country that could serve as an example, and we found that a lot of them were really data heavy, and we wanted to make the information more accessible. So we tried to come up with more graphic, quick bites of information that would really emphasize the key points that we wanted people to be aware of and hopefully focus their energy on.
In doing that, did you have any concern that you were in any way, dumbing down some of this data?
I don't think so, because ultimately what we're trying to do is drive people to the Aloha Plus dashboard, which gives a whole wealth of information. So if you want to dig deeper, you can have access to that information, but this just gives you the top line things to really pinpoint where awareness should be.
We should mention that this data is not new data. You simply were able to draw it together and funnel it through this report in ways that you thought would be accessible.
That's right. Yeah.
Where did the data come from?
So the Aloha Plus dashboard. So a lot of the folks that are involved in this effort are also funders of the Hawaii Green Growth Initiative's metrics efforts. We recognize without good data, we're not going to be able to have the conversations that we need about understanding where are the benchmarks, where are we, what have we done, and where do we need to go. And so we put a lot of effort into funding that, which you can access on the state's website, but then kind of taking that to a next level. And so they aggregate a lot of data from different departments, state departments, organizations that are working in these areas. So pulling what is available out there and trying to bring it together into a resource that everybody can use.
But also some way using it as a litmus test for your own funding. I mean, as a group with the 17 or the 15 organizations and two individuals who were part of this, because every funder wants to know that its money is going to be used well and appropriately and
Absolutely.
With what kind of reporting has to happen afterward. So does this in fact become sort of a benchmark of how you will fund and what you will fund going forward?
I think it's definitely a framework for us. I think it helps crystallize our thinking in terms of, what are the key issues? Where do we really need to shine that bright light? And how can we put our money where the environment is, and really make a difference there and hopefully bring others along with us?
Have you already begun to look at what you want to do next year?
Definitely. I think, we're looking at, we started with the data that was currently available on the dashboard. And each year they're adding more data in different topic areas. So I think we're going to go down the list and tackle the next three and then maybe do a little bit of a check-in on where we've made progress on the first three that we started with.
Which kind of brings me to the next point of how well will you integrate all this as opposed to just doing three and three and three if you say you're going to track mm-hmm. the progress of all of this to be able to fully integrate what you've done so far and not just simply be moving down the dashboard as they are producing data.
Right. So I think we're still formulating what that's going to look like. We wanted to get the first report out there and get people talking and get some feedback on how effective they feel it is in helping form opinions and awareness and understanding of the issues that we're trying to address. And then we can shape what the next report looks like from that. So, I think in our conversations with people as we roll this report out, we're going to be asking, what is it that you want to see in terms of the benchmark? And that'll help shape how we continue the conversation about the issues that we're dealing with today in this report, and then next year adding in the additional topics.
The topics that you chose for this year, obviously tracking the dashboard, but freshwater security, when we know that we've seen so little rainfall, and that rainfall over the past several years has been generally decreasing, and forecasts are that we are going to see drier areas get drier. Mm-hmm. this is not necessarily, you know, good news or news that we haven't heard before, but what do you think that this particular report may spur that others have not?
So I think it comes back to the accessibility of the data. So really drawing people into understand the key issues in a simple way. So drawing a larger audience, perhaps, than would have otherwise been focused on it, and really kind of getting them engaged in understanding where the problems are. Hawaii Community Foundation has done a great job with its freshwater initiative and trying to bring key stakeholders together to have those conversations. And so I think it's poised us to be able to further that conversation. And this report brings folks to the table. Hopefully, that's what our goal is.
How will you know if they're coming to the table?
Well, I think we'll see increase in funding, both from the private sector, but also from government, hopefully. And I think also just having more people contact us, reach out, try to ask the right questions and continue that conversation.
Beyond the funding part of it, though, bringing them to the table in understanding, which seems to be the whole point of putting this out so that people can get bits and pieces of issues that are going to affect them if they haven't already, seems to be, you know, the larger question. How will you measure, or will there be a way of measuring, you know, public engagement?
So, I think we're still working through exactly what those measures are. I think measurement's always a challenge, but for us, this report serves as a tool to try to bring people in. So whether we've increased clicks to the website, or we've had more folks asking for copies of the report, or we find that the legislature is having larger conversations with people who are coming in to really drive that. So they bring the report with them as a tool to start that conversation. I think that's where we'll see that this report is having an impact.
So if you wanted to start a conversation with someone who may be listening to this, what would you tell them that you found as being two or three important points that they should walk away knowing?
Gosh. Well, I think for me, in terms of fresh water, that our goal is to increase to 100 million gallons per year by 2030. 100 million gallons by 2030 saved. What does that mean? How do we get there? And sort of use that as leverage for that conversation. And then I think from Ulupono's perspective, obviously, we're interested in that 100% renewable RPS. So, you know, how can we bring the right stakeholders to the table to have the conversations with the utility, nonprofits, folks who are working in private sector in those areas to really move that forward in a meaningful way?
All right, Amy, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Amy Hennessy is the Director of Communications for the impact investment firm Ulupono Initiative. We'll talk more about Helono Moko, the State of Environment Hawaii 2016, tomorrow on Town Square. Meanwhile, a link to the report will be on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
Aloha, I'm Chris Okuhara from Miso and Ale. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want to do.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. This story is about how the spark of giving was ignited by a bottle of beer. In 1971, Edward and Norma Doty's company, Eagle Distributors, became Hawaii's exclusive distributor for Anheuser-Busch. Eagle rapidly turned Budweiser into the largest selling beer in our state, making them the biggest wholesale beer operation in Hawaii. After Mr. and Mrs. Doty passed, their family wanted to give back to the community, so they established the Edward J. and Norma Doty Charitable Fund, which has given financial help to many organizations, including the Child and Family Service, Queens Cancer Center, and the Alzheimer's Disease and Related Disorder Association. Let's all lift our glasses high and toast the Doty family for turning what some consider a fun beverage into something that provides serious help for those in need. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you. I'm Bob Wehrman. In today's Backyard Quiz, we thought about a Greek businessman in late 19th century Hawaii who was a supporter of the monarchy and sought its return to power. He was part of a group of local Greeks who remained loyal to the monarchy in the wake of the overthrow and found themselves at odds with the missionary elite that engineered it. Those communities had long been in conflict due to business rivalries and competition in the pineapple and export industries. The businessman we're thinking of this morning was one of the most committed advocates of the restoration as a member of the Scheutzen Club, a front for so-called counter-revolutionaries. He apparently suffered from mental illness in his later years and was committed to the Andrews Asylum for the Insane in California in 1896, where he died under mysterious circumstances a year later. His family believed he'd been murdered for his political views. His death caused a stir back home in Hawaii. Peter Camarinos had been a prominent member of a close-knit Greek immigrant community.
And that was the name we were looking for, and Roy Chang knew it, called us from IAEA, and we'll get the T-shirt. Thanks, Roy, and thanks very much for all the likes that we see from you on Facebook, too. Thanks a lot. And if you would like to send us a quiz question, you can always do that at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
We feel helpless in the grip of anxiety or chemical dependency or any of the other ways we have of losing control. But what if we could see what's going on in our brains? Would we then be able to control our most damaging compulsions? Neurofeedback practitioners say that we can, and that we can use neurofeedback as a tool to overcome such afflictions as attention deficit disorder, chronic anxiety, and drug addiction. Stephanie Garcia teaches its techniques on Maui, and she's on the line to give us some background. Good morning, Stephanie.
Good morning, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Was that an accurate description of the benefits of neurofeedback?
Yeah, that was a really good way of summing it up.
Because it's about visualizing brain waves at essence, yeah?
It is. What we do is we actually use EEGs, so electroencephalographs that take the raw data from the brain and brainwave activity, which is reflecting our inner physiological activity, everything from our blood pressure to heart rate and body temperature. And we use that data in the form of brainwaves and feed it back so that you can actually see in action what is happening in the brain, and therefore be able to self-regulate those brain waves that become out of balance.
Well, let's say a person is afraid, you know, is in a state of high anxiety about something. Does that look different?
Absolutely. So that person, we'd say, is probably looking at their EEG. They would have high beta. They'd have a high level and amplitude of beta brain waves. Mm-hmm. And so we would work to calm that down, because that would be most likely a state that person is in a normal environment, and an environment where it shouldn't be. So those brainwaves are really good when we're running from lions or something like that, but not so good when we're showing up to the office or, just in our daily dealings with people.
Yeah, presumably.
So,
In a clinical environment, you'd be in a place, if you were showing anxiety in a situation like that, you'd be in a place where there was nothing immediately to be afraid of, right?
Exactly. And so, so through our questionnaire, we do a 90-point questionnaire before we get started with anyone, and that really gives us a good gauge on the person's brain chemistry. along with choosing about four main major growth areas that the client wants to see in their own life. People have a pretty good grip of what their ailments are and what they'd like to fix when they come into my office.
Mm-hmm.
And we use the EEG to see, you know, which brain waves are dominant, which centers of the brain are over-aroused or under-aroused, and we're able to then train brain waves to function the way that they're meant to.
Well, Stephanie, let's say somebody comes in who's got a chemical dependency, you know, alcoholism or a drug addiction. And obviously that's going to yield, if they're, let's say they're hurting, that's going to yield an EEG that clearly shows that something's out of whack, right?
It would. People with addiction, they have, you know, a lot of different brain waves that are different from people who are not addicted. And, you know, these rote behaviors just become commonplace. And people who have addiction, you know, their brains have been hijacked. And, you know, it's interesting that you bring up addiction because, you know, EEG biofeedback, which is another name for neurofeedback,
mm-hmm.
Has excellent results with people with addiction. It's used, the system I use is actually used in most PROMISES treatment centers all over the nation. And it's the number one neurofeedback system used in mental health facilities.
Well,
but
here,
back to your...
Here's the question that comes to mind, Stephanie. You know, somebody who's that in that kind of serious trouble with addiction, are they really going to be able to think their way or calm their mind, think their way out of the problem without some kind of, you know, chemical assistance or some more radical type of intervention? Does that can work?
So I think that this is a more radical type of intervention. We find that, you know, with 12-step treatment is effective, and so is talk therapy. But we have found that with neurofeedback that, you know, with all the studies that have come out, you know, through UCLA and other research centers, that people who use 12 sessions or more of neurofeedback, that they tend to remain abstinent from drugs and alcohol for over a year by 70%, which is huge if you look at the typical rates of relapse.
Oh, yeah.
And addiction.
Well, so you're in a session with somebody who is addicted, and you clearly see this in the brainwaves. What do you tell them to do to abate those problems?
Well, you see, I don't really tell them to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
The software does it itself. What happens is those people typically, they'll do an alpha-theta session. So typically with these people, they have high fear centers, right? Their brain has been hijacked by this fear, and early sobriety is very scary because the brain has learned to associate the drug with, you know, the same things as getting air, food, sex, water,
sure.
Right? And
happiness,
so,
so
when we see this, you know, what we typically do is we decrease beta, which is, you know, the fight or flight, right? The fear centers that cause people to, you know, abate from treatment and leave treatment. Which, by the way, neurofeedback keeps people in treatment upwards of 60% longer than people who don't use neurofeedback, which is just astounding. But we use alpha-theta training. So what that does is it increases the thinking part of the brain. It increases the meditative part of the brain. The Chicago Tribune calls it brain paint, the system I use, as like meditation on steroids. And the person's able to, instead of having their, you know, their fear centers hijacked, once they get a trigger, you know, they see a trigger or they see stress, a stressor that'll remind them of the drug, remind them of that relationship that they feel that they need in order to survive. But instead of going straight to the fear centers, and you hear the stories of people that just say, I was just driving along and I turned into the liquor store. I had no, I didn't even think about it. Instead of that, what happens is we find people with neurofeedback, it calms down the alpha centers. The alpha brainwave is the idle rhythm of the cortex.
I'm sorry to interrupt. We're almost out of time, but it does sound as if there's enormous possibilities here. We really have to run. Thank you very much for talking with us.
No problem. Well, thank you for having me.
Sure. Stephanie Garcia is a neurofeedback practitioner with an MA in Marriage and Family Counseling, who owns Maui Family Counseling and teaches neurofeedback techniques to social workers, addiction counselors, and marriage and family therapists. You can find out more about her and her work on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Well, that's going to do it for us for this Wednesday morning, but we promise we will be back with you tomorrow. And we're going to sit down with A&B's president and CEO, Christopher Benjamin, to get an update on what's been happening with the laid-off sugar plantation workers. You'll remember that at the beginning of the year, the HCNS plantation said that it would be closing. We're going to find out more about that, also about the restoration of streams in East Maui.
And we'll look at the role of the kuapu, our altar, hula culture. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talk back line and leave us your comments at 808-792-8217. Email is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
And if you want to be in touch with us at any time, you know you can always post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation or get to me at BKOZHPR. If you missed any of the show, all you have to do is go to our archive. It's on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. Look under The Conversation. It's just there under talk shows.
I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning with more of The Conversation.